Hello and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast in which Lowy Institute researchers and our special guests delve into the big issues in international affairs. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Nathan Law, a young Hong Kong democracy activist who I first met 5 years ago when I was the Hong Kong correspondent for the Financial Times. Nathan was then a student leader, and I followed him around the city as he ran for a seat in Hong Kong's Legislative Council. He was remarkably elected as the city's youngest ever lawmaker, but soon afterwards, he was disqualified at Beijing's behest on the basis that he didn't take his oath of allegiance properly. Nathan was subsequently jailed for his leadership role in the 2014 Umbrella Revolution and returned to activism in Hong Kong in his release. But he eventually fled the city last year after Beijing imposed a draconian national security law in response to the unprecedented protests of 2019. Nathan joins us today from his new home in exile in London. So thank you so much for joining us, Nathan.
Thank you so much, Ben, for the invitation.
It's great to connect again and to find out how you're doing. I mean, Nathan, I was doing some research before the call and shocked to discover that you're still just 27 years old, which is really hard to believe given how much that you and Hong Kong has been through over the last decade. It's now, I think, more than 6 months since you moved to London in really self-exile.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I think London is a welcoming city. As Hong Kong citizens who've been living in the city for a very long period of time, you can find similarities between two cities because like Hong Kong was a British colony before 1997 and a lot of cultural heritage is there. So I think my life here has been all about advocacy and trying to voice for Hong Kong. So in the past 8 months, I've been performing that role, and I hope that, well, for now, I'm free from the threat of national security law so that I could speak up for Hong Kong a little bit more than the others who are still in Hong Kong.
Obviously, it was a pretty serious threat that forced you to leave. The new national security law, which the Chinese government imposed on Hong Kong, brought in really tough penalties for colluding with foreign forces, as they say, for advocating for secession, really for criticizing the government or challenging its authority. And I know that you were put on a wanted list not long after you left. But what do you think would have happened to you if you hadn't got on that plane and fled to the UK?
Yeah, well, that would definitely be arrest and detained. And you never know when you could step out of the jail. So since the implementation of the national security law last June, we've been observing the implementation of it, showing the aggressiveness and how arbitrary it is. There are more than 100 cases under the law, including the 47 participants and organizers for the democratic primary took place last year for the Legislative Council election. And some of the cases, the arrestees are just holding protest signs, chanting protest slogan. And in regards to the primary election case, the government says that these people who participated the primary election because they wanted to go into the council and veto the government's budget. So they are committing a subversive act, and that is totally absurd. So basically, the national security law provides the government a very convenient legal weapon to prosecute dissidents that they don't like with any observed reason that they could fabricate or they could think of. And if I were in Hong Kong under that circumstance, I would have been arrested for long. And just to bear in mind, the maximum penalty of the national security law is life imprisonment and even extradite back to mainland China. So I think Joshua Wong and the Chow and the others who are facing the national security law charges, they are in a very precarious situation.
Yeah, it's been really shocking to see how quickly not just the implementation of the law, but how quickly the authorities have used it and how broad the definitions of national security have been. And during the 4 to 5 years I lived in Hong Kong, worked as a journalist and a researcher, I interviewed so many young activists like yourself, Joshua Wong and Agnes Chow, who you mentioned, but also many older activists, people in their 60s and 70s, and practically every person I know who was in the democracy movement, either as an elected legislator, a student activist, a legal activist, they're all either today in jail, facing trial, or in exile. So it's been incredibly shocking to me as an outside observer. Have you been surprised by how quickly Beijing and the Hong Kong government, which is really operating under the direct control now of the Chinese Communist Party, have you been surprised by how quickly they've moved to accelerate the repression in Hong Kong?
I think many of us are surprised by the speed of that, even though we can understand that that would be the trajectory of it. And that is why we stepped up and resist in 2019, because if we don't fight back, the trend will only be like that, and there is no possibility to change it. So I think for many of us, the speed of deterioration is appalling. If you look back to 2019, we didn't really expect the national security law coming in 2020, which basically the Beijing government, from the start of releasing the information of having that law to imposing that law, that duration was only 2 months. And that was much faster than any proper legislation process. And the government, the Chinese government, circumvented all the legislation and consultation processes in Hong Kong in order to impose it as quick as possible. So I think that speed is something that we didn't expect. And I think for now, the international community also reacted in quite a strong way. And after the national security law was imposed, many countries uplifted the extradition treaty with Hong Kong, the UK government extending the arms embargo, and a lot of safe harbor and safe boat plans, policies were introduced. These are responses to imposition of the national security law, because the world also got off guard when it was introduced. So yeah, I think the speed of it is incredible, and we're just like trying to get used to it.
As I mentioned a bit earlier, it's really been a roller coaster ride over the last decade. From 2012, when there were these early student protests against an attempt by the Chinese and Hong Kong governments to impose patriotic pro-Communist Party education, the Umbrella Revolution of 2014, the massive street protests and sometimes violent clashes of 2019, then the imposition of the national security law. I mean, since you've left Hong Kong, have you had time to really think about what's happened in the last decade, to take it in at a personal level? Or do you still feel like that you haven't had time for your feet to touch the ground?
Well, I think we all are in a state of continuously thinking about what has happened in Hong Kong for the past decade and try to learn something from it. And I think the emergence of the 2019 movement was actually a lesson learned from 2014, which the movement really emphasized in leaderless and no severing matches, which we call like don't split, remain unity. And these are lessons drawn from the 2014, because when the 2014 movement, when the leaders were being prosecuted, were being targeted, when a lot of internal divisions were being triggered inside the pro-democracy camp, these are the reasons why the movement faded. So I think the whole city have always been in a state of revisiting the past and learn from it and try to move on.
That's, I guess, the political lessons. But what about at a personal level? It's obviously, it must have been really hard for you to leave your home, to leave your friends behind. Some of them, as we know, Agnes Chow, Joshua Wong, among others, in jail right now and facing more charges. I mean, how hard was it for you just personally to leave? And how hard has it been kind of sitting outside and seeing what's been happening to your city and your friends and family?
Yeah, that is a very tough decision. In last May to June, it was when the news about the implementation of the national security law was coming out. We were actually at first didn't know the content of it. I think not until a few weeks before it was put on the discussion in the National People's Congress and they immediately passing it, we finally realized the true content of it, and that was extremely draconian. And by the time that I had an understanding of how it looks like, I immediately realized that people in Hong Kong are no longer able to freely express their opinion, and any speech that is criticizing the Chinese Communist Party or urging international pressure put on the human rights violation of mainland China and in Hong Kong will be considered breaching the security law, and it will lead you to severe punishment. So I had, by the time I needed to think a question, which whether we need someone to have that recognition and have that profile and to continue to speak up for Hong Kong free from the threat. Because in Hong Kong, you're basically silenced in terms of the speeches that you can make. So for me, it was just like a week or two's time to think about that particular serious questions, which, to be honest, it had never popped up into my mind. When I finished my study at Yale, I actually went back to Hong Kong at the end of March to try to run for the primary election. By the time I didn't have a thought of leaving Hong Kong, not until I realized that the national security law was coming. But I actually made that decision fairly quickly because I think I have the ability and I have the recognition to be able to voice of Hong Kong outside Hong Kong. And I think it's important that we remain vocal on the international level because that is the very few leverage that we have. And we need the world to understand what Hong Kong people genuinely thinking. So I think that decision I took was actually quite straightforward.
Okay. But it can't be easy because as I understand it, you know, yourself and other activists from Hong Kong who fled often have to cut off connection with your friends and family because of the way the law is worded about collusion with foreign forces, that, you know, there's a risk that you could endanger your friends and family if you maintain contact. Is that, am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I actually issued a public statement after I left Hong Kong saying that I severed my relationship with my families. That was because when I took reference from the implementation of the national security law in mainland China, for example, when those human rights lawyers being arrested, their families got intimidated, they're being surveyed, their wives cannot leave the country, their students cannot go to school. You'll understand that it's not about any individual, but it actually endangers your families. So I took the decision of severing my ties with them for their own safety. And I have not been in contact with their activist fellows in Hong Kong because, yes, definitely, the government would fabricate evidence and saying that they're working with me and I'm endangering the national security so that they are colluding with foreign forces assisting my work. I try my best to avoid that from happening. So I actually haven't in contact with them. But yes, I miss them a lot. I worry about them. They are facing severe threat and intimidation. And I really hope that my work outside could alleviate that kind of worries and tension that they're receiving.
Yeah, it must be really, really difficult. And, you know, yourself and so many others like you have obviously sacrificed so much for the fight for democracy in Hong Kong, which I think is really powerful for people in the outside world to see, where we talk a lot about democracy in our countries, in Australia, in the UK, in the US, but very few people ever have to make difficult decisions to try and fight for or defend that democracy. And that makes me want to ask, you know, to go back a bit to the root. Why is democracy so important to you and to the people of Hong Kong? You know, it seems that, you know, many of the 1.4 billion people in the rest of China are happy to live without it. Obviously, Hong Kong does have a different history, but what is it about democracy that is so important to you? And do you think there's also an element of this which is actually about identity, your unique Hong Kong identity, and fighting to retain that as much as it is about, you know, freedom of speech and democratic elections per se?
Well, I think it's a conglomeration of factors of why we're fighting for democracy. First of all, it's a promise, basically. It's a promise made in 1999 when Hong Kong's sovereignty was handed back from the British government to the Chinese government. But then we were so terrified by the political turmoils in mainland China and the way that they rule the country. So we hope that we have a guarantee on a system that our basic freedom will be expected, will be respected, and our way of life can continue. So democracy was promised as an appeasement to Hong Kong people, saying that even though they're being ruled under the communist China, that they will enjoy their way of life regardless of what their mother country is. And second would definitely be in reaction to the socioeconomic situation in Hong Kong, we've basically the most serious wealth gap in advanced region. Our housing property is extremely unaffordable. People that experiencing a lot of economic difficulties. And I think many of them consider that as a result of an unrepresented electoral system, because in that system, the business sector and the pro-Beijing sectors, they got a larger share than the ordinary people. So policies are inclined to benefit them instead of the general public. And definitely identity is one of the problem, one of the issues that we're looking into, because we think that as long as we have the ability to elect our own leader, reflecting our own willingness, I think that is a demonstration of a community and unity. And it's definitely more meaningful than letting Beijing to pick someone who we think that does not belong to our community. So I think that identity is also something we wanted to represent it in our own electoral system.
I mean, talking about identity, I remember when I was researching my book on young people and identity in Hong Kong, something you told me, which was very poignant at the time and seemed to kind of, in a way, get to the heart of some of the issues that Hong Kong was facing then, which are now obviously much worse. I think it was something along the lines of, we're talking about the Chinese Communist Party or the Chinese government, and you said something like, people think we hate them because we don't know them. But the truth is, it's because we know them that we hate them. And you know, you yourself, you were born and lived the first few years of your life in Shenzhen, over the border in mainland China. I mean, what's your sense? Why couldn't the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, just leave Hong Kong alone? Because it seems the more they've pushed Hong Kong, the worse the backlash. So why is it that you think that Xi Jinping, the CCP, couldn't just let you guys get on with your life, let you have your, you know, limited freedom and democracy? Why did they have to push so hard?
Well, I think one of the concerns that they had is the spillover effect. Of course, for now, the very first priority of the Chinese Communist Party is to retain their power, to centralize their power, and they don't want any concept of division of power affecting people's hearts and minds, especially in mainland China. So if they let go Hong Kong and let Hong Kong get its freedom and democracy as they deserve, then that may create a spillover effect into mainland China, which trigger the kind of a revolutionary political uprising that Chinese Communist Party hated to see. So I think that is a major reason why they're doing so. And I think for another reason, which is actually related to the situation of Taiwan, is that the function of Hong Kong as a role model for one country, two system is gone. On the one hand, the one country, two system was designed to show to Taiwan that with a so-called reunion, then you can still enjoy democracy and freedom, so that they don't have to have military conflicts or things like that to convince the Taiwanese people to be united with the Chinese government, basically. and that have felt dramatically in the past few years. If we look at the domestic election results in Taiwan, so Beijing has basically abandoned, setting Hong Kong as an example for Taiwan. And on the other hand, when Xi Jinping got his power, they have a strong confidence on their path. They have a path confidence, cultural confidence, system confidence, that they stop thinking that they have to catch up to the Western liberal system, and they don't have to treat Hong Kong as a gateway, as a demonstration to show that they have a certain intention to open up themselves, to liberalize their system, to democratize their system. And because of that big backdrop, that they don't have to, well, kind of show to the world that through the lens of Hong Kong, they can easily destroy Hong Kong's system. So I guess the fall of Hong Kong emerged in these big backdrops. And for now, it really takes a lot of international pressure to urge Beijing and to say that we actually are still monitoring your actions and trying to hold you accountable, and you must show that you're progressing to a certain direction that we think is the best for your people and the best for the advancement of human rights. And I think as long as Beijing decided to restore that function of Hong Kong, showing progress, showing a liberal side of the country, it's difficult that we can overturn the situation.
Yeah, difficult indeed. And it's got a lot more difficult because in the past, when Beijing has tried to exert its power over Hong Kong, it prompted these big mass movements in 2012, when there was a push to install patriotic education in 2014, when there was a push to stop Hong Kong being allowed to elect its leader democratically, and in 2019, when there was a drive to bring in this extradition bill that would have allowed people to be extradited to the mainland. But now, these days, the costs of opposition are so much higher. There are fewer and fewer avenues for political pushback because the elections have been reformed to basically prevent any kind of activists or people who believe in true democracy running for election. And as we said earlier, most of the key leaders like yourself and your friends are in jail or exile. So do you think we will ever see another wave of protest in Hong Kong like we saw multiple times in the last few years?
Well, I definitely believe that there will be another wave of protest. It's not about how severe the government suppress people, but it's about how determined they are. And well, social movement has its own cycle. There will be lows and highs, and I think we're definitely in the low tides, and we have to try to protect ourselves and try to go through it and to wait for another protest in the future. And I think for now, it's just we have to get used to the new norm, the new Hong Kong that are set by Beijing, that they could impose a lot of speech crimes, a lot of arbitrary detention, and deploy many different suppressing tools to silence us. But once we kind of like get used to that situation and we go into another phase of the protest, there will definitely be possibility for people to rise up again. It's about time, and it's about how we can sustain our voice even though we are in this very suppressing time.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable. You say that the more Beijing pushed Hong Kong in the last decade, the more actually people became united, to at least amongst the kind of 50 to 60% of Hong Kongers who want democracy, the stronger that sense of identity and sacrifice became. But I guess Beijing's thinking, like the Communist Party often does, long term, right? That they're thinking about the next generation of kids who'll grow up now and will never know freedom in Hong Kong. So I guess their bet would be, if they don't know it, they'll have no desire to fight for it.
Well, of course, Beijing has been introducing a lot of schemes to try to like brainwash the younger generation. Even though the national education subject was being dismantled, but it actually was turning into a much more subtle and more creative way into our education, and also trying to impose a very positive Chinese Communist Party regime image into our students, younger students. So I think like those projects are ongoing, and for us, we have to be very aware of that and try to mobilize our civic society to counter it. We've got our teachers and professors and many civil society actors that they could deliver the right idea to the students. So I think in Hong Kong, we still got a vibrant society, even though it's suffering a lot of suppression. But I guess like for now, we still have that mentality and the ability to counter those brainwashing education and old schemes initiated by Beijing.
I mean, talking about kind of the long fight, you recently signed a charter for Hong Kong with a number of other exiled young activists who I also, many of whom I also got to know over the years in Hong Kong. And you talk about kind of the long battle towards liberating Hong Kong and a Hong Kong that's democratic and free and autonomous. But under what circumstances, you know, given what we know about China today, given what we know about Xi Jinping, under what circumstances could Hong Kong truly be free? Do you think it would be the end of Xi Jinping's reign in power, whenever that may be? We know he's potentially, you know, chairman of everything for life. So is it the end of Xi Jinping you have to wait for? Or do you realistically have to wait for the fall of the Chinese Communist Party, if that even ever happens, before Hong Kong can truly get, you know, the freedom and autonomy that, as you said, it was promised and that so many Hong Kongers desire?
Well, it's difficult to foresee how the ways that freedom arrive in Hong Kong. I think it depends on many factors, and it's not something that would happen, I mean, for a decade. So it's definitely a long-term project. And I think under the current state of the governing mentality of Chinese Communist Party and the one-party dictatorship and the concentration of power that they are obsessed with, it's definitely difficult to kind of like predict a situation that Hong Kong enjoys democracy, but under the one-party dictatorship of Chinese Communist Party. So possibly a liberalization of the political system in China is also an important factor to facilitate that in Hong Kong. But nonetheless, I think there are many different avenues to achieve that, but they're all very difficult. And for now, for me, my prior concern is how we can accumulate capitals for resistance for our Hong Kong people. It's not about money, but it's about a sense of struggle, a sense of determination, and to building up our identity, building up our understanding to the Chinese Communist Party, and also building up generations of young people who are aware of the situation and ready to resist. So I think this is something that I'm really I'm aware of, and all the international advocacy work that I'm doing is also raising awareness to that point.
I've been reading a lot of history recently. I studied history originally, and one thing that strikes me is how in the past it was exile of people like, you know, Sun Yat-sen or time spent abroad, Ho Chi Minh, that really kind of forged, you know, their views of the world, that actually allowed them to internationalize their movement, to build global networks in support of, you know, the causes of independence and revolution that they were fighting for. And eventually, after a long period of time overseas, to win their particular battles. But obviously, Beijing, the Chinese Communist Party, has its own experience of crushing democracy movement in the mainland. And I guess their hope is that, as has often happened with mainland dissidents, that once you're overseas, activists kind of fall into infighting, they lose relevance, connection to the motherland. I mean, for you and your colleagues, I mean, what's your plan? How are you going to try and stay relevant to Hong Kongers and their struggle when you're so far away?
Well, for now, we've got the advancement of technology. Everything that I'm doing in the UK and in Europe can simultaneously be shown to Hong Kong people, and they recognize the importance of it, because all the major prominent activists in Hong Kong are either jailed or in exile like me. So they are really looking up to what we are doing outside Hong Kong and what impact that we could bring. I think the only way to stay relevant is to continuously commit yourself into the advocacy work and showing that you are connected to the people in Hong Kong and you are not giving up on them. You are determined enough to walk one more mile with them. So I think if my work are not recognized by Hong Kong people, then I'm cool to stay irrelevant and let the capable people to be the role that they should be. But for now, I think the work that I do is for really, like, because I see it as important and crucial, and I'll continue to do it for my Hong Kong and for the people that I love.
And obviously that's staying relevant to Hong Kong. Is the other part of it is trying to influence the international community. And I know it's something that you and your colleagues have thought carefully about. Another former activist, former legislator, Ted Hui, recently moved to Australia to kind of open a front here, as it were. Because I know there are other activists in the UK, in Germany, in the US. How are you planning to kind of maximize impact internationally? How are you going to keep focus on Hong Kong struggle?
I think for now, Hong Kong advocacy in exile is still a relatively new thing for us. We have to have more time to construe it, to understand it, and to try to bring the maximum impact. So for now, I think in each of different regions and countries, we've got different political contacts, we've got different composition of exile activists, we've got different local organizations that we have to communicate and work with. So I think for now we're still in a very rudimentary stage that we need at least to have more time to understand what's happening. So for me, I'll still engage with the local politics, engage with politicians, and try to outreach as much as possible. But from grassroots level and more local level, I have not started my work on that, so I may have to wait for a little bit longer time in order to work on that front.
Through your international advocacy when you were in Hong Kong as well, you met many key players and gave testimony in front of the US Congress. You met Mike Pompeo when he was Secretary of State. I mean, have you been relatively reassured that the new Biden administration seems to have carried on the settings from the Trump administration of taking a really tough approach to China, but obviously, hopefully, in a more thoughtful and concerted way? So are you encouraged by what you've seen so far from the new US administration? And how important do you think the role of the US is in trying to bring some restraint, I guess, to the pressures that Xi Jinping is putting on human rights for so many people across China, not just in Hong Kong, but obviously in Xinjiang and Tibet and elsewhere?
China policy is one of the very few things that both parties in the US could agree on. And that is a certain continuity from the Trump administration to the Biden administration on the how they strategize the China policy. So I think the Biden administration, of course, have some more leverage and advantage on uniting with allies and making coordinated actions and the sanctions on Monday that the EU, Canada, the UK, and also the US coordinated was a great example of how the Biden administration could pressure China through works in alliance. So I think definitely we will be seeing a different set of policies, but showing the same intensity of the assertiveness towards China. I think, yes, definitely it is crucial for the US to use their position to unite the democracies and to pressure China, because I think the authoritarian expansion incurred by the Chinese Communist Party is a global issue that we have to work together to solve it. It's not only about the political or economic warfare between the US and China, or it's not because like two superpowers are fighting each other. It is actually a survival crisis for the idea of democracy. And I think the only way that we could restrain China is by collaborative efforts from all these democracies. And we have to realize that if we do not reverse the decline of global democracy, then we will witness the expansion of the authoritarianism, and it will eventually affect every one of us who are living in democracy. So I think US plays a major role in here, but they are not the only one who should be responsible for that fight. Every one of us should be involved.
Yeah, talking about collaborative efforts beyond government, it's been fascinating for me as someone who studies Southeast Asia as well as Hong Kong, to see some of these nascent connections that have been growing up between democracy movement in Hong Kong and some Southeast Asian countries, including in Thailand, in Myanmar, where obviously at the moment protesters are facing really brutal violence from the military there. But quite incredible to see, you know, how the protesters dress in yellow hard hats and black t-shirts. It, you know, almost looks like, you know, some of the front lines from Hong Kong in 2019. And some people have talked about this milk tea alliance, because obviously people do drink milk tea in those three countries. But, you know, do you think there's much to those connections? Is there much strength that these different movements can draw from each other, given the very different contexts in the different countries? And is that something that you plan to work on in future, to try and forge those links, not just with government and with Hong Kongers, but with other democracy struggles around Asia?
It's important that we vow our support to each other, because what the authoritarian regimes are afraid of is unity, is solidarity across the world. And for me, the Multi Alliance is a virtual community that we can support each other who share the same values and who had the same struggles and pursuit on democracy. So I think that would definitely be one way that I am working to. And I've been paying close attention to the protests in Myanmar and working closely to their activists overseas. And I really do hope that our encouragement could help them even the slightest. So that is something that I'm really looking forward to work more on that.
And you're in London now, Nathan. We know that the British government has made quite a generous offer, saying it will allow several million Hong Kongers who hold this British national overseas passport to emigrate to the UK in some shape or form. I mean, a lot of people would say the UK should have done much more earlier to help Hong Kongers, but it's obviously better that they're doing something now. I mean, are you expecting a flood of Hong Kongers to join you there, to flee the city and try and set up their life in the UK and elsewhere? Or do you think, you know, for those people who aren't so politically active, maybe they prefer a more democratic and free Hong Kong, do you think they'll just rough it out, tough it out in Hong Kong and take advantage of the low tax rates and the fact that sort of business carries on in many ways? Or do you think there will be a huge exodus in the next few years?
Well, I think whether to leave Hong Kong is a very personal issue. I think every one of us have different consideration and restraints and weighting different factors. So I actually think that there will not be a million like outflow of Hong Kong people. But I guess the estimation of the Home Office for the first year of Hong Kong, of the number of Hong Kong people using BNO routes, it is quite accurate in my opinion. It's like 150,000 Hong Kong people. I think that that is more or less the reality, given that we are in a pandemic, and also there are certain political and economic instability of the UK after the Brexit campaign. So I think, yeah, definitely there will be an inflow of Hong Kong people, but I just don't think that will be a very dramatic figure.
Yeah, as you say, it's a really tough decision to make, and not one that people will take lightly. Nathan, I just want to finish off by kind of asking you to look back a bit on your career, or I guess your life and activism in Hong Kong. I mean, you've done so much. You've been through a lot alongside many of your colleagues and comrades. I forgot to mention at the beginning, you found time to get a master's at Yale University somehow in the midst of it all. I mean, looking back over the last decade or so, I mean, is there one moment or an experience in Hong Kong that for you kind of encapsulates the struggle, what you and other Hong Kongers are fighting for? Was there kind of a particular incident, a particular place, something you saw that really gets to the heart of what this is all about for you?
In 2017, I remembered vividly that I lost my seat in July and I was jailed in August. In just 1 month of time, I was kind of like degraded from an honorable legislator to an inmate, and it was actually quite an impact for me. But after I pounded and really think about that journey, I realized that is a journey that many Hong Kong activists would have to been through. And that will be a depiction of Hong Kong's future, that we were once Asia's freest city and we enjoy a lot of reputation and recognitions, but we will soon be fallen into a position of a police state, an authoritarian city, and Hong Kong people would no longer recognize that city. And I think that 1 month's experience echoes to the encountering of Hong Kong under the hands of Chinese Communist Party. So I guess that is a memorable moment for me, but it also says something about Hong Kong.
Well, it's a memorable moment, that's for sure. Not a happy one, but you know, you obviously shown so much grit and determination, and I really appreciate you taking the time, Nathan, to share your thoughts and your insights with us today. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute with production assistance from Jennifer Reinhardt. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you next time.